hear she's very good. She's got good sponsorship, I do know that. So to introduce you, I haven't heard her speak, but I'm sure she's going to do just fine. Thea.
All right, my name is Thea, and I'm an alcoholic. I have been sober since December 8, 2014, and for that I'm extremely grateful. I was a little disappointed that we didn't get to the announcements, because 45 minutes is a long time. Thank you, Roger, for asking me to speak today. I hope I don't get you fired. And I do appreciate that you called me last week and said, you know, people really love to get out early, so it's okay if you don't fill up the whole time. We'll see what God's plans are today. Let me start by saying that I am really grateful to every speaker who comes to Club 12 and who shares in any meeting, the speakers who come before me and those who will come after. I do view this as an act of service, and I keep coming back because I keep hearing things that I relate to and things that help me recognize that I am an alcoholic and I belong here. So to those of you who are new, who are friends who picked up new chips today, or you're kind of wondering whether or not you belong here, I just hope that you hear something in what I share today that that you identify with and that sounds familiar to you. So I guess let's get started. I don't know why I'm an alcoholic. I know that it runs in my extended family. I'm really grateful to my two parents, and they're, you know, luckily they did not have alcoholism for them personally, but my dad's side of the family, he's the eldest son of seven children, and he has two older sisters, but partying was always my grandparents' first child. And I know that's something that really affected him and his siblings growing up. He also lost a brother to this disease about 7 years ago. And it's just something that definitely has shaped the way that he was as a parent, and just our relationships with our extended family. And on my mom's side, her father, she was very close with him, but not so much with her mother. Her mother was physically abusive and verbally abusive, and also suffered from this disease. And actually, her mom passed away when my mother, when I was about, say, 18 months old in a drunk driving accident, and she was the only driver. And so as a result, she was in a coma, and my mom had to make the difficult decision to discontinue life support. And so that was, that's definitely something that shaped my mom too. And my parents did the best that they could raising me, and they're wonderful parents. They're still together, and they're just a loving family. And so there's really no reason, you know, for the way that I was brought up that why I would be this way, but I knew I was different. You know, I've always had that feeling of just not fitting in with anyone else growing up. And I was raised in Rockport, a little touristy coastal town, and I didn't have many friends. It was like really hard for me to fit in with people. And so instead of getting, you know, doing normal things like playing games with my classmates, I would sneak out of the classroom and like go play with the cat in the yard. And I identified with that. Like, I'd rather go play with an animal than try and hang out with my fellows. And, you know, I just felt that sense. I think my only friend growing up was my neighbor, and I only liked her because she had more toys than I did. And so right off the bat, you know, I was looking for people to give me things and not really for who they were, not to connect to them, but to what could I get out of this situation. So when I was in the fourth grade, my parents quit their jobs and just kind of on a whim moved to another touristy town called Fredericksburg, not too far from here. Great little city, great little town, and I had a really, I guess, a lovely childhood. I have a younger sister, luckily she's here today, Katie. She's really, really wonderful, and I'm glad it worked out that she could be here. But, you know, growing up, again, we moved into this town and we're like, what are we, like Norwegian, Irish, Mexican? And we move into this German town where the families go back hundreds and hundreds of years. And it was just really hard to find a place there. And so I would come home and just be in tears because the girl next to me didn't want to be my friend, or, you know, just had many of those experiences. And then eventually what that turned into was that as I did eventually make friends, they weren't good enough for me. And I always had my eye on, like, the popular crowd. And I don't know what it was, but it was just, like, people that I was surrounded by were never good enough, but I was not good enough to hang out with that other crowd over there. And that just kind of continued through middle school and through high school. And when it comes to drinking, you know, and it's weird how things come to you, like, the longer you're sober, but I remember not too long ago that I made my first, like, memorable drink. I think I was 10 or 11, and it was Y2K, and we were at this church event for the millennium, and everyone was drinking champagne, and I asked my mom if I could have a sip of hers, and she said yes. And I just remember taking that sip and just, like, feeling warm and just feeling all of those good fuzzy feelings. It was just a sip, so it wasn't enough to get me wasted or anything, but I immediately knew that I liked the way that made me feel. And what was more is that all of the kids who were, like, 13 and 14 took a bottle of champagne to the youth room in the back of the church. And so when I went there and saw how much fun they were having, I was like, yes, this is it. Like, this is what I want to do. I want to be like them. And so I acted a fool just on that one sip of champagne. But I saw how it affected them and how everyone seemed so happy and jovial. And then, I don't know, you know, I guess, in growing up, I always wanted to be with the people who were older than me or had more knowledge, and I wanted to fit in, and I just couldn't quite get there. So high school for me was a lot of just trying really hard to be someone else than I was, and I just really didn't feel like I fit in. I didn't feel like I had anything to offer. But then I would use people to try and fill those areas inside that just didn't click with anyone else. And then in college, it was the same deal. Hold on, let me back up a little bit. Like, senior year is when I really started to party a lot. I did find that in with the in crowd, and it was drinking. And I worked for a catering company, and they would give me, like, bottles of wine at the end of the night to go take to my parents, and that never happened. And so, you know, I had something to offer, finally. Like, I had a way to connect with people. And I remember I skipped class. This came to me again not too long ago. I skipped class. It was, like, Spanish class. And I went on a little roadie with three other girls, and we stopped at my house and got a bottle of wine, and we actually went back to class that day. Everyone that we passed in the hallway, like, they knew we were drunk, they knew that we had been drinking, we smelled like it, and then I didn't face any consequences because I was able to hide it from my family. And so, the more that I was able to do that and indulge in alcohol without getting caught, like, that was awesome. And then came the time that I did go to a party, and I lied to my parents about it, and I did get caught. And because my mom was a high school teacher where I went to high school, and she found out, and then my tennis coach also found out, they came up with a plan that, like, oh, we're going to make her run 5 miles every morning before school for 2 weeks. And then I was like, okay, well, so what? So I did that, and it was miserable for 2 weeks, and then I just picked up right where I left off. But that was really the first, like, major consequence that I experienced from drinking. And then in college, it just kind of got worse. And man, this time does not go very quickly. I don't want to bore you guys with stuff that happened in college, but one thing that I heard a speaker say once is that hers was a disease of booze and boys, and that was something that I really identify with. Because I started to use men and some women and drinks the way, you know, interchangeably. Like, I had this emptiness inside, like, this thing that just wasn't quite meshing, and I used men to kind of, like, make me feel better. And then when that didn't work out, I would go drink at them. And then when I felt like shit the next day from drinking at them, you know, I would keep doing this vicious cycle. And really using people to replace alcohol, and then using alcohol to replace people. And that really, that's been the case for the last, I'd say, 6 years. And it's just kind of gotten progressively worse. I guess in college it was kind of cute because it's like, oh, well, everyone's doing this, and you get a week before school starts to just, like, hang out and go to frat parties, but then when class actually starts, like, that's when you're supposed to get your stuff together. And my freshman year, I actually missed my first test because Halloween was the night before. And, you know, that's ridiculous. Like, why would you put Halloween before a test? But, so anyway, I missed that and nearly failed the class because of it. And, you know, my grades dropped really quickly my freshman year, and then I don't know what happened. I think I got a boyfriend or something sophomore year, and it scared me enough that I was like, man, I actually have to pass college. Like, I can't just come here and waste all this money and then throw it away. So I kind of held it together for a couple of years, and then when that boyfriend and I broke up is when I really started to, like, drink at him and just do all these things and use it as an excuse for the way that I was. And my behavior was not okay. You know, I was hurtful to a lot of people, and, you know, did a lot of things that I, you know, today I wouldn't, if I did that, I would not be proud of it, you know. And it continued to rack up and weigh on me, and eventually I graduated. I actually got fire under my butt, and I was like, I don't want to be in this place anymore. And so I graduated a semester early and then made my first geographical, I guess, by way of graduating. I had to move home with my parents because I couldn't get a job out of college, and that was a huge blow to the ego. And then I, you know, for a couple months living at home, I hung out with the people who never left Fredericksburg, and those people, like, outside issues, and I indulged in a lot of them, and then and it was, again, just this really destructive, like, I was hating myself. I was like, why can't I get a job? Like, why am I this useless person? I have a degree, but it doesn't mean anything, and, you know, I'm working at an old lady shoe store. Like, I don't know, it in my head, it was like that was what the problem was. It was my head. Some other phrase that I've identified with a lot in these rooms is an egomaniac with an inferiority complex, and, like, that is me 100%. And it's weird because, like, the bigger my ego grows, like, the worse my drinking gets. So eventually I got out of that situation, and I found a job that brought me here to San Antonio, actually. And that job, I got to fly around the country, and I got to drink at open bars, and so it was really fun. But serious things started happening. I would have, like, these really crazy blackout experiences, and my blackouts would get worse and worse and worse. And one day I was, like, in Orlando, Florida, and I didn't remember the last 5 hours of this open bar, and I was there with a bunch of, like, insurance agents, and some man, like, followed me back to my room, and then some other guy that I had been friends with earlier that day was like, no, you come with me and hang out in my room for a little while. And then luckily, like, nothing happened. Like, only by the grace of God did I not get, you know, murdered or something that night. But the next day, all I could think of was, oh man, I hope my boss doesn't fire me. Like, okay, like, I should be a little more worried about that. I should be worried about how my actions got me to the place I was. And I didn't, you know, and so it continued for a few years, and I got another job, and that job, it was a little better, like, in pay and in stature, I guess, but I started to get bored, and I didn't have any friends in San Antonio when I moved here, but I very quickly found out, you know, where the people hung out who drank like me, and so I found a girl who I became really, really good friends with, or really good drinking buddies with, at least. She was always down to go out and down to party, and she was the one person that I could say, well, as long as I don't drink as much as she does, then I'll be okay. As long as I don't get to that point, then I'll be okay. And that's really dangerous for someone like me, for an alcoholic like me, because when you start to compare yourself to someone else, then you can justify your behavior. And that's what I did. I did a lot of justification, and again, like, I had these really scary experiences. So let me fast forward just a little bit. So about 3 years go by, I get out of that job, and I get, like, my dream job. Excuse me, I forget. So I get my dream job, and I'm like, yes, I've made it. This is awesome. And this happens, I think, July 2014. So we're getting close. And I get this job, and it's really cool, and I get to brag to all my friends about it. And around this time, I started hanging out with people who were a lot older than me, who had a lot more money than I did, and a lot of access to things that I would not normally have access to. So I got to go to Spurs games all the time. I got to go to these great parties. I got to just be seen, and I loved that. And again, my ego was getting bigger and bigger, and my drinking was getting worse and worse. And so that year, I had the first instance where, like, somebody left me at my apartment, locked me inside, and then 15 minutes later, I was calling them in the middle of my street, wandering around in front of my apartment, not knowing where I was, and they had to come back and get me. And that was really mortifying, because this was, like, one of my really good friends, and she was the first person to say, that's not okay. Like, that's kind of scary. You might want to take care of that. I never tried to quit my drinking before it actually happened. I did go on a diet once that it was supposed to be 30 days without alcohol. That was part of it. And I got, like, again, Halloween got in the way. So I got, like, 20 days in, and that was it. It's weird how Halloween just, like, happened in there. But anyway, so I did have another instance where I went to a Spurs game, started out there, slamming beers, went to a bar afterward and saw a guy that I had been dating with another girl. And because I could justify my anger at him, I just started drinking and drinking and drinking and tried to fight somebody when they tried to put me in my car and wanted to take the keys away from them so I could drive myself home. And luckily I got home safely that night. But again, it was like somebody said the next day, like, I'm really scared for you. And it didn't make a difference. And that's, you know, I guess that's how this disease works, is like we can have people on the outside telling us that they're scared for us, but it's not until we feel that for ourselves that it becomes time to actually do something about it. So the fun part, So in We Agnostics, I'm really grateful for this line. It says, page 44, if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. I never tried to quit before, so I don't really identify with that part, but I never knew if one beer was going to stay one beer, or if it was going to be four mixed drinks or six shots. I never knew what was going to happen after I took that first drink. And I know that's very much the case for me today. So when it came time to identify myself as an alcoholic, I was grateful that it's really up to me. You know, it is up to me to decide that I am alcoholic. And so my last week, I guess I was one of those high-functioning alcoholics, and I always justified it by saying, well, if I don't drink every day, and if I don't drink at work, and, you know, the lines that it goes through, then I'm okay. I don't have a problem. But the last week that I was out, I did drink every day, and I stayed out till like 4 a.m., and I blacked out twice that whole week, and it's like, that's really, really intense. And I remember it was a Thursday night, I went out, I didn't stop partying until 4 a.m., somehow I was able to go to work the next day, and I got thrown this huge project, and this is as I'm trying to, like, crawl under my desk, because I am so hungover, and I want to die, like, I feel awful. And so I get handed this big project, and somehow I nailed it, and I get all of this recognition afterward, and people are congratulating me, and so that night, I go out, I drink just two beers, because I don't want to go crazy two nights in a row. But then the next day, my friends came, and we started drinking at noon. And they came and picked me up in an Uber, because that's before Rideshare had left. And then we went to a festival. Long story short, I drank that entire day. I don't remember the last, I guess, 8 hours, because I blacked out around 10 p.m., and the next thing I knew, I wake up on the floor of the Bexar County Magistrate's office in the isolation cell. And I was like, oh, great. Okay, so I'm in jail. That's cool. how did that happen? And then I'm like in my little Ann Taylor romper and some cute flats. And so I'm there and I think, okay, well, you know, at least they put me in here by myself because I know I'm not like the rest of the criminals. But really, it was the drunk tank, and I was so intoxicated that they thought I posed a threat to myself and to others, so I was there alone for a few hours. And I eventually find out, you know, some of the reasons why I got arrested, And apparently when I was dropped off at my apartment at 2 a.m. by, well, anyway, not the people that I started the night with, I had gone to like every bar in downtown San Antonio, made quite the trip. And after they dropped me off, at some point I decided to get in my car and try to drive to a guy's house down the street, like 2 miles away. And on the way, I nearly hit a cop. And so, that's why he pulled me over. So I got pulled over. Luckily, I did not hit him. Thank God. I did not hurt myself. I did not hurt him. I did not hurt anyone else or cause any damage. And that is an absolute miracle. Because I guarantee you, this is not the first time that I drove like that. And, God willing, it will absolutely be the last. So my BAC, after I completely failed the field sobriety test, and I read all this later in the report. I have not seen the video today or anything, but anyway, I slurred a bunch when I was talking to him and was trying to tell him like where I worked, and it was just really messy. But my BAC was a 0.32. The cop thought that I was nearing alcohol poisoning. He thought I was going to die like on the way to the jail, which is really scary. And I know what happened earlier that night that again justified my drinking that way was that I again saw a guy that I had been dating, and he was with someone else, and that made me mad. That was it. It pissed me off, and so I wanted to drink at him, and I did. And anyway, I just knew when I woke up in jail, I was like, this is where everything has gotten you. Like, this is where you have gotten yourself. You cannot blame anyone else for this. Your best doing, like your best thinking, your best everything got you here. And it doesn't matter what, great thing you did at work, or if people think you're cool, like there's a problem because you keep trying to drink to kill yourself. And I do, like that is what I do. I feel this emptiness inside, and I try to drink because I don't want to feel that way, and I don't want to feel emotions. And so, done. I think I kind of took a little bit of the first step, and I knew that I was powerless over this, and I had to stop drinking, and that my life had really become unmanageable. It didn't really look like that on the outside, but inside it really felt like that. So, by the grace of God, I finally told my family about it. And mentioned, I don't really know what to do at this point because I had never heard, I didn't know what Alcoholics Anonymous was. Like, the only time I had ever heard about it was in movies or in the back of the church bulletin growing up. Like, hey, Alcoholics Anonymous meets these days. But when I mentioned it to my sister, she drove from Lubbock down to San Antonio, and I'm very grateful for the Central Service Office because you guys welcomed her in and highlighted all of the best meetings in the book. So thank you so much, because it was only because of that lining up the way that it did that I actually had a little glimmer of humility to actually go to my first meeting. And so I remember it was a Wednesday, and there was a women's meeting that somebody had recommended, and it was one of the highlighted ones, and I had talked myself in and out of it, out of going like 30 times. Like, I even remember the last conversation I had with my mom that day was, I don't think I have to go. I don't think I need to go to this. I think I got it. Like, I've gone 10 days without drinking so far. Like, I'm solid. So, like, my mom, I'm sure she was like, okay, well, if you think that's what you need to do. And then I was mad at her because I'm like, how dare you? So I went and ran after work. I ran like 4 miles, and then, because that's a normal thing to do. And then finally, God took over and made my feet run back to my car, and I drove to the Alamo Heights Methodist Church that evening, and like a good newcomer, I showed up sweaty and late. And I remember opening the door with the little AA sign, and this little old white-haired lady turns around. They've already started the meeting, so I'm, totally rude, but she turns around and she just looks at me, and she could probably tell, I guess, and she goes, "We're so glad you're here." And that's Sister Brenda, for any of you who know her. And that was it. I found a spot in kind of the front of the room. I didn't know that if you knew that you should hide in the back. But there were these two girls there, and they well, there were a lot of women there, but these two girls who were kind of my age, you know, looked to be kind of like me. One of them, really friendly, was like, "Why are you here?" And I was like, "Well, I kind of got arrested." And she was like, "Oh, you have a DUI? No worries. Lots of us have those." And then I can't, you know, after that, I can't really tell you anything that they said in the meeting. I can't tell you anything that happened. But I did meet a girl. Actually, no, it wasn't even me. Like, that girl came up to me after the meeting. She was chairing that day. And she was just like, "How are you? You know, do you know what a sponsor is? Do you want to come to a meeting with me tomorrow?" And really reached out. And that woman eventually became my sponsor. And I do owe a debt of gratitude to her and to anyone who reaches out at the end of the meeting, because I think, at least for me, like, that's when it mattered. You know, like, I could have just skipped out and been like, "I don't know how to feel about this. I'm not going to go back." But no, you know, this person came up and these people were really welcoming. And for our new friends, again, like, if you don't feel anything except for welcomed and loved and welcomed, you know, like, that's it. Like, you're where you're supposed to be, you know? And I don't have any idea what happens for you after this, and nobody does, but we're really glad you're here. And I know how much of a difference it made in my life, so it looks like I have just enough time to get sober. But no, you know, so I got a sponsor, and my sponsor had a sponsor, and still has a sponsor. And we got to work right away on the steps. And, you know, like I said, I had already kind of taken the first one without realizing it, but there was no doubt in my mind that I was powerless over alcohol. I did not identify with calling myself an alcoholic, and I do want to say that, because if anything, like, that scared me. You know, in my head, the alcoholic was, you know, like, the deadbeat dad, or, like, the homeless man under the bridge, or the woman who's, like, on the corner, you know, downtown every morning, and just because she was there the night, you know, from the night before, and I had this, like, really, really crazy, well, whatever, it was, a typical view of an alcoholic, and then, obviously, we are many different kinds of people now, and I know that, but I did not identify with calling myself an alcoholic for a couple of months, I would say. I would say it out loud, but it took a while, and it took working the steps, and now I know that that is not a bad thing, that actually being an alcoholic is the best thing that has ever happened to me, honestly. So, you know, I guess the higher power thing, it didn't really freak me out, but I never thought much about God, except for when I was praying to not have an STD or be pregnant. And I'm serious, y'all. And so, you know, I think it's in the 12 and 12, or maybe it's the Big Book. I'm really bad at quoting it, but where it talks about we were like selfish children asking for presents from Santa Claus. Like, that was me. Like, that was how my relationship with God was. I only asked for something when I was in a jam, or if I really, really wanted something that I didn't have the means to get. And the beauty of this program is that my higher power is between me and my higher power, and it doesn't have to look like yours, and it doesn't have to look like yours, and it doesn't have to look like anyone's in here except for what it looks like for me. And, you know, in however many months, like 20 months of sobriety, like, it's taken a lot of different forms. Most recently, it's taken this very feminine form, and my God is one who just loves me unconditionally. And someone who I can turn to when I'm terrified, like when I had to speak for 40 minutes in front of Club 12. Or, you know, my God is somebody I can turn to every single morning, whether I'm scared or happy or no matter what I'm feeling. Like, my higher power is with me at all times. And that is such a miracle. It is so amazing. And it gives me a reason to, like, get up and to try and be helpful and to change my attitude every day. And I'm getting emotional, but this program has just given me so much. And I'm not going to do the thing where I go through all the steps up here, but I guess one of the things that, whatever, I'm going to skip. So I have a lot of shortcomings, and what I do like about this program is that it's never done. Like, you don't just get to step 12 and then you're done. I do like that you get to go back and do it again, and then maybe a year later you get to do it again, and so different things crop up at different times. And I get to work on them, and I get to take an honest inventory of maybe some of the negative behaviors that I have, and I get to see what the opposite of those would look like. And I get to see, you know, if I stop feeling fear about this thing, when can I look at the truth and realize, like, it's not actually like that, and here's what you can do to try and make it better. And so working with a sponsor has given me that. You know, when it came time to choose a sponsor 2 days in, I found somebody that clearly knew what she was talking about when it came to AA, and somebody who had just a little bit more time. You know, I think she had a year or so sober, and that seemed attainable to me. You know, it kind of seemed crazy, like, well, a whole year without drinking is really intimidating. But she was able to give me her experience, strength, and hope, and show me how to do that for myself. And that's, you know, that's really cool. Like, except in AA or any other 12-step program, like, where do you get somebody to do that? Like, where it's just you and this other person, and you could be completely different and come from all these different walks of life, but you have this one thing in common, and it's that disease. And what you can give each other is how to get out of it, or how to not let it ruin your life. And I don't know, that's just really cool. So when it comes to step 8 and step 9, I don't know if, you know, maybe I did it wrong, but I only had like 10 people on my list, and I think that was a good start. I've definitely had people come back on it, or not come back, but pop up on it since then. But one of the biggest things for me was that I kind of like run the show with my family, and like I mentioned, I have a sister, but you know, I didn't really have a lot of regard for the way that they felt or their feelings, and I would definitely show up hungover all the time to family events, and just really tried to rule, like be the one in charge with my family, and that was not okay. You know, I had like this younger sister, and we were only 2 years apart, and so it's, you know, I don't have to be the one in charge all the time, and I was just so reckless in my drinking, you know, like with my life and with other people's lives. And and the ninth step, the eighth and ninth step, has given me the ability to make amends for that, and I have a relationship with my family today, and I'm gonna get emotional again, but you know, my sister is like my favorite person in the whole world, and it's because of this program that I can be a sister to her too. So, excuse me. Anyway, so moving on. the 12 steps are just really wonderful, and I'm grateful to Bill and to Dr. Bob. Because it's so weird that this program wasn't here, you know, like 100 years ago. And it's so wonderful that it will be, you know, for hundreds of years to come. Okay. I'm blaming this on Famous Dave, because he prayed with me beforehand, and that just, like, set me off. So, anyway. One of the really cool things about this is that I get to be useful to other people. And since going through the steps myself, my sponsor said right away, you know, okay, now it's your turn. And so because of that, I've been able to work with other women, and to help them on their journey of recovery. And, you know, I have a couple of really awesome sponsees who are here today. So thank you so much for being here. And, it's just really cool to get to see like this change happen in somebody else's life. I don't know if I'm crying so much. I mean, I know y'all get it, so it's like, it's really okay. But no, it's really cool to see this change happen in somebody else's life, because I don't think you get, or at least for me, I didn't get a full grasp of how powerful this program could be until I got to watch that happen. And so that's really like, that brings me a lot of joy. And the best parts is, you know, I could be like going on with my life and doing something, and then I get a manic phone call from somebody who needs help, not just, you know, not just a sponsee, but like anyone, my friends. And then I get to be there and to listen. And I never did that before. Like, I never listened to somebody else for what they were going through. And that's what this program gives me, is that ability to just be a friend and a fellow, and to identify and to have somebody else identify. And I guess let's talk about friends. Like, I'm going to talk about something happy because I don't know why I keep crying. But like, again, like I said before, like I did not have friends. You know, I had drinking buddies and I had people who could give me things that I wanted, but I never had friends. And, you know, this program, it took a little while for me to just decide to jump in with both feet when it came to the fellowship. But this fellowship is amazing. And, you know, I have, for the first time, I have friends who are younger than me and older than me or my same age. You know, I have like generations of friends, and it's only, again, it's only because we have this thing in common, and that kind of levels the playing field, and there's no fear in that anymore. Like, I get to go up to somebody that I don't know and introduce myself and then ask them to go to coffee, and like it never, you know, it was never that simple before, and that was just because I got in the way of doing that. But I'm going to celebrate one of my best friend's weddings today, and she is getting married to somebody that she met in the program, and that's just a really cool thing to watch, and to be genuinely happy for somebody and to celebrate them, and to know that, you know, we're gonna be a group of sober freaks dancing tonight at this wedding and like having a wonderful time. And I could never do that at weddings before. Like, I was always the one that they had to like drag out at the end of the night. So I guess I'll go back a little bit to my DWI, or what I got arrested for. I didn't even go to court for it for like a year. And so I had just a couple months over 1 year sobriety, and then I actually went to court. And this is kind of funny. I'm just sharing this because hopefully somebody has been through this, or you might go through it. But one of the parameters of my probation is that I had to wear an ankle monitor for the whole term. And it's called a scram, and it's like this huge ugly thing that you have to wear on your ankle. And which was awful because I don't like wearing pants, and I had to wear them for like 6 months. And it's a thing that Lindsay Lohan wore, so. You have a picture now. Celebrity alcoholics are just like us too. Anyway, so I had to wear that, and that was, I had a lot of fear around it, which sounds dramatic, but I do work, you know, I work in a professional environment, and I like to wear skirts and dresses, and I was like, oh my god, they're gonna know that I'm wearing this huge thing on my leg, and I got through it because I found somebody else in the program who had also gone through it, and we, again, like, we have this huge fellowship of people that we get to just ask, like, you know, what have you been through, or I'm going through this, have you been through this too? And I found somebody, another girl, who was also cool and also liked to wear skirts and dresses, and she was able to get through wearing an ankle monitor too. And I got it removed early, so you can see I'm not wearing it. So that, you know, that was actually a miracle. We had I had just about a month of summer to spare, and then my sister and I went to Schlitterbahn yesterday to celebrate. But you know, so that's like a little thing. Not life or death, you know, if I had to wear it for the whole year, whatever, I would have gotten through it because this program teaches me how to get through anything. So I heard it in the rooms. My sponsor did not tell me this, but I did hear to not date or make any other huge decisions in your first year of sobriety. And I took that to heart because, like I said, booze and boys, like I was all about it. And I knew I had a problem with it. And so I didn't date for my whole first year of sobriety. And I'm really glad because I think that the kind of person that I am, I totally would have seen any of you beautiful men in the audience and probably tried to cause havoc. And that's not what this program teaches me. So I was a little over a year sober, and I went on my first date. And it was so scary, and I got to pray through the entire thing, and it did end up working out with that guy. It did not work out, but he was really nice, and I was able to be a lady about it, and like I said, I got to stay close to my higher power through the entire thing, and that's really how it should be all the time. And I recognize that, and some days I'm good at it, and some days I'm not. You know, I don't work a perfect program, and that's just such a wonderful thing about this, is that it is all about the progress. And as long as I'm making progress or willing to make progress every day, then I'm on the right path. And, you know, there are some things that I still really need to work through. you know, like right now, my drinking is not unmanageable because, you know, I'm working the steps, but my like finances are unmanageable right now. And I recognize that it gets really easy to like replace alcoholism or drinking with another addiction. And I don't want to do that. And so my, you know, there are areas of my life where I know that I can also work this program. And I heard in the meeting, I think I wrote it down. I heard in the meeting that this program is fire prevention, not fire extinguishing, which means you don't have to burn your life to the ground to start working the steps. And I really like that because that means that anytime, you know, it's just up to me. Like when I'm ready, when I decide that I am in enough pain, but I don't even have to get to that point, like I can start working this program on any part of my life. I don't know if I was going to share this, but so like, okay, well, so rape is a part of my story too. And it's one of those things that like my human, compassionate, feminist side is like, well, that's not your fault. That's never your fault. That can never be your fault. But then like the other alcoholic side of me is like, well, look at this thing that you, like, look at these steps that you took to get yourself into this situation. And the things that you did to bring yourself into this unsafe place. And so I just wanted to share that because it is something I still need to work on. But you know, maybe somebody else in this room has that experience too. So just know that you know, there are other people in here who have gone through that. I guess I don't want to end on that note, but this program has just given me a life. Like, it has given me so much, and it has made me a sister and a daughter and a friend and a human, you know, like, I think my ego still kind of gets out of whack sometimes, but like when I'm freaking out about stepping up here and talking in front of a bunch of my friends and people who I love. But you know, I can use this program for anything, and I'm just really grateful that it's given me a life and that I get to meet all of you. And I'm really, you know, grateful for the Women's Big Book on Wednesday nights and the Tuesday night Big Book study, Bobby J, and then this meeting as well, you know, on Sundays, and then all the other meetings. Like, San Antonio is so wonderful because we have like hundreds of meetings here, you know, and if you get a resentment in one, you can go find another one. And you know, they're at all hours of the night, and so I know, like, when I'm sitting in my own stuff and letting it really eat at me, it's just up to me to get in my car and go somewhere and to be around all of you. And to remember that, like, I belong here, you know, I belong here and I earn my seat. And as long as I have the willingness to show up and to do the work, and to ask for help when I need it, then hopefully I'll be coming around for a while. So thank you all so much for everything, for my sobriety, for letting me be of service today.